Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Ecom Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And joining me today, it's been far too long, 4, 5, 6 weeks, I'm not sure, back on the podcast, Bill D'Alessandro. He is longtime returning guest, pretty much, you know, honorary host at this point, the co-host of the Acquisitions Anonymous podcast, where they dissect really interesting deals in rapid fire. If you're not listening, you should absolutely listen, as well as author of a great newsletter and consulting service as well for e-com and finance. So Bill, good to have you back, my friend. Always love having you on.
I'm glad to be back. I feel like this is an e-commerce podcast. You have to mention that I own and operated e-commerce businesses for over a decade.
Sorry.
You need to say that at the beginning.
You sold the business. We're cutting you off, man. You get 30 days. That's it.
Well, I was afraid I was going to not be invited to ECF Live, but I had already bought my ticket before I sold it.
To my life, Bill. Welcome to my life. So,
yes, e-commerce interloper / carpetbagger.
Now we've just got two complete interlopers here. Zero credibility, except yours is much more recent than mine. Yeah, we got ECF Live. This is going to be coming out. Man, this will be coming out in a week and a half before ECF Live. Everyone coming to Bozeman, which very excited for. Got a good crew, 260-ish plus people descending. We are just going to blow up downtown Bozeman.
I picture us taking over downtown Bozeman. Like, it's like going to rename, the mayor's going to rename the town for like declare ECF Day, right, in Bozeman, the whole thing. I'm so excited.
Well, this is the first time ever we have had to, instead of just have one hotel we contracted with for a room block, we had to contract across three different hotels to be able to get the crew enough rooms for us to kind of get situated. So, but it'll be a lot of fun. Hopefully the weather will be good. It can be a little fickle at times, but yeah, you've been downtown Bozeman. Bill, for people who have not been to town, and it's been a couple of years since you've been here, but what's your impression of kind of downtown?
I mean, it's an awesome kind of like Mountain West town, right? Like, it reminds me a little bit of Boulder, which I don't know if Bozeman people would think is pejorative or not, but it does remind me a little bit of Boulder. I mean, it's super livable. You know, it's like walkable. I'm picturing this like Woodstock for e-commerce people. We're just going to be crawling all over downtown Bozeman.
Yeah, it'll be super fun. Definitely more options for bars and after parties. I remember for people who have been to who went to Norfolk ECF Live, there was, I mean, even at like, man, the whole city shut down at like 10 p.m. There was one bar that was open past 10 p.m. And I think two or three nights in a row, it went from having three or four patrons to having like 120 patrons in about the course of 10 minutes. And I can't tell if they were thrilled or furious with us, but we definitely put that one bar on the map. So,
have you given them a heads up in Bozeman? I assume you know everyone who owns all the businesses in downtown Bozeman, right? So they know what's coming.
Don't know them all. Don't know hardly any of them, but we'll give them a heads up. We'll be a little more polite this time than we were last time.
And this is going to make you put you on the map in Bozeman. Like, this is the guy that takes over Bozeman once a year for ECF.
Yeah, Park. It's going to turn me into the infamous guy who's like, who is this dirtbag who just brings
him ruining downtown Bozeman ruining with all these tourists. Yeah.
Haven't you seen Yellowstone? That's the whole point. Everyone gets furious because all the people come in. So I'm going to be the most hated man in the city here in a couple of weeks. No, it'll be a lot of fun. And then also a shout out. We just announced our dates for Ecom Camp, which is our event for our eight-figure founders, April 13th through the 16th. We are going back to Palm Springs, California. And yeah, it's going to be a great time. We're going to be also heading back to the BMW driving experience if you head on out for that. Of course, a chance to connect with great founders and great owners, but we're going to get out, drive some fast cars, enjoy the desert. It'll be a good time. So make sure if you are in the community or that sounds interesting to you, April 13th through the 16th next spring.
I love the live events. They are the highlight of ECF membership to me.
Yeah. It's always good. I always tell people that if being in the event business in and of itself, I think is just absolute masochism at its finest, because they're a ton of work. Trying to make money that way would be extremely difficult. But as a way to build a community and reinforce bonds and connections and strengthen a group of people, I can't think of anything better. So it's always a ton of fun when we do them. And it's always an incredible feeling at the end once they've gone off without any major snafus. So yeah.
Gotta be anyway, fun.
Looking forward to seeing everyone. Bill, so a couple of things to chat through. We have got kind of these, have you come up with a better name than the state of play for our episode?
No, I think it's de facto the state of play at this point.
All right, state of play until Bill renames it here. As is the tradition, we will tend to just kind of hop onto the forums and see what some of the top topics and discussions were. And obviously, you need to be sensitive to confidentiality and certain specifics, because obviously it's a private community, but really directionally talking about some of the threads, some of the things that aren't confidential, to give you a taste of what's been going on in there, and in case you've missed it or in case it sounds interesting to you. So one, it was kind of fun. I don't think we spent too much time on this, but it was cool to see, you know, we're recording this in early September. There was a thread somebody posted about vacations for ECF members. And it was cool to see, I mean, so many of us are heads down a lot of the time in the business. It was cool seeing people take some time off in August, travel with their families, some of the perks that entrepreneurship can open up. It made me think about the importance of rest. But yeah, people headed to Europe. There was people that were getting out on the lake. There was people that were just kind of relaxing with family and staycations. It was fun to see all the cool stuff ECFers were doing. Bill, did you do the European chill Speedo, take a couple of weeks off in August thing?
No, I didn't go to Europe, so I couldn't wear my Speedo. But we did.
you can totally wear it. And Speedos are in huge South Carolina. In Charlotte, right? Yeah.
Yeah. No. We went down to South Carolina. We go to Fripp Island, South Carolina, every year for a couple of weeks. So we were down there, you know. And then I'm gearing up for a whole bunch of travel. We're going to Penn State. My wife graduated from Penn State, and I've never been. So we're going to a game at Penn State, which I'm very excited to experience, having gone myself to Wake Forest University, which is like 6,000 total students. So to go to a Penn State football game is going to be amazing. We're going to tailgate, like, whole thing. I'm very excited for that. And then I'm going to Mexico with my college roommate to kind of celebrate the sale of the business in October. So that's going to be great. So I've got some good travel coming up.
Nice. Very cool. I do think it, as much as Americans tend to be workaholics and entrepreneurs tend to get after it, August is such a good time to chill out, take some time off, and recharge for the year coming up. So it was cool to see. We'll link up to that if you want to see what the other ECFers have been doing or did do in the summer. We'll link up to that along with all the other things we're going to talk about. There's another interesting thread that popped up about one of our members, and again, keeping it high level, was talking about how they dove into influencer marketing and affiliates for 6 months. And kind of thoughts on that and thoughts on how influencer marketing has evolved and changed. And they talked about ad whitelisting, which is something that I was not until recently kind of more familiar with. Bill, are you pretty familiar with ad whitelisting with influencers?
Yeah, we did a fair bit of it at Natural Dog Company.
Yeah. And did it seem like it was, so ad whitelisting is when instead of Natural Dog Company putting out their own advertisement on their own social account, they will actually pay to promote posts within the influencer's account. So it appears, so it's coming kind of more from a first person. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Bill. But was that something for you guys that was pretty effective relative to just doing it on your own branded account?
Yeah, it's broadly more effective just because it seems more authentic and it looks less like an ad. So, you know, the standard MO that a lot of brands do are you're commissioning content from influencers. And our mutual friend, Andrew Ferris, always loved to say that influencer is just another word for bad actor or amateur actor. But like some of them are good and can create good content. Of course, it's about sort of the portfolio effect. Like you commission a bunch of content and some of it is good and most of it is terrible. But if you have a good one, what you want them to do is they post it on their account and there is a way in Facebook Business Manager for them to authorize you to be a whitelisted brand. And then you can run ads. You can promote the posts, you know, the ads that are in their account, they get billed back to you. And the influencers generally like it because you are expanding their brand, you're promoting their posts, right? And the brands typically like it because the click-through is better and it's more authentic.
Yeah. And guessing most people that are heavy down this, you know, this path are pretty familiar with that. The thing that I was curious about, and wait, your take, Bill, I made a fairly large purchase recently. So we moved from Tucson to Bozeman, and as part of that, to help survive the winters, ended up buying a sauna. And I realize this is, you know, kind of a stereotype.
You are such a bro. Oh,
I know. Such a bro, right? Like this is, the cries about, you know, the brohood are going to get, probably get lambasted for it. But in Montana, always enjoyed them. And we bought one. And I bought this brand. It's called Sisu Sauna. And you'd think as a marketer, I was a little suspicious out of the gates because I couldn't find any organic reviews. They don't have any reviews on their website. All of the reviews, they partner up with a bunch of like fitness influencers, and they've got all these glowing, of course, testimonials. And there's a few Reddit threads that talk about it a little bit. And anyway, long story short, the The product is reasonably built, but it's got some design flaws, especially with the roof. Customer service was okay, but I was not as blown away by the sauna as I was expecting to be. And to me, in the back of my mind, I kind of knew this going into it, you know, but I think after seeing, after having the product and experiencing it and realizing, hey, there really wasn't a lot of like independent reviews or third party. And most of the hype that I saw about it was influencer based, even though I kind of knew it, it left a little bit of a taste in my mouth with the whole model that I'm going to be more on the alert for going forward. And it's almost like with Amazon. I know we've had a long and storied, you know, slightly different perspectives on Amazon over the years, but I feel like while they have started to, they're kind of in the intermediate phase of people being a little skeptical of some of the brands, especially the no-name brands on Amazon. I wonder how much of that is coming to the influencer market more broadly. So I don't know if that's just given that experience, are you feeling that at all on the consumer side, on the marketing side? What do you think, Bill?
Do you feel, I'm kind of surprised it's 2025 and you are just experiencing some cynicism for influencer marketing just now. I mean, I feel like, you know, there's a whole bunch of e-commerce people listening to this podcast. I have been ruined on reviews and influencer marketing for a decade. I mean, like everybody on this podcast knows that Amazon reviews can't be trusted, influencer reviews, like everything. The whole internet is bought and paid for. And like, I mean, even ChatGPT now is all SEO'd and Reddit is totally SEO'd and like it's everything is fake. The whole internet is fake. To me, it's almost hard to, you just got to have a good return policy. And if you don't like it, send it back.
Yeah. No, and that's very fair. I think maybe what was different for me was this was more of a niche product. There wasn't a lot of independent reviews. It was a big ticket purchase. And the number of influencer marketing pieces out there was substantial. And they were high production value too, right? And again, I don't want to trash this brand. They did do a lot of good things right. But I think the degree to which I realized there are brands now that are built almost entirely on influencer marketing at the expense of other things. Because I always think about influencer marketing as like one of the tools in the quiver, right? Like it's what you use alongside of other things, you know, word of mouth, SEO, all this kind of stuff. But the degree to which it has for some brands become the only thing or the primary way in which you build a business, I think is just, that I think is what stood out to me a little bit more along with the fact there was a bigger ticket purchase. So
yeah, I mean, I think it's now functionally table stakes. Like you're going to start an e-commerce business and you're not doing, you know, don't have a creator outreach program. And I mean, because how, it's the double whammy, right? You're doing it to generate content for ads, but you're also generating a bunch of content. Like mm-hmm. this is kind of the best practice, right, in meta advertising these days, is to be doing this.
So I mean, how do you, and I'm flipping our hats from business owners to consumer side of things, how do you research stuff? Like where do you get unbiased information? Or do you just assume everything is biased? You do as much research as possible. I mean, even Reddit has a degree. We had a good friend of mine is that we had on the podcast 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he's a guy that does it with integrity, but you know, he's in business for helping brands market on Reddit. So yeah, I mean, I feel like this is one of the reasons where maybe not a tipping point, maybe I'm just having my own little existential crisis here because of this one thing, but it's kind of sad that I feel like the internet is going to start almost contracting a little bit in terms of smaller siloed areas that people trust because, I mean, long way of saying, how do you get, when you're buying stuff, Bill, where do you look for information you trust?
Yeah, I mean, it's been so much worse by LLMs being totally pervasive now too. Like, I mean, it's all fake. All of Reddit is fake, even if it seems real. You know, it's crazy. There's this concept called the dark forest theory of the internet. Are you familiar with it?
If not,
no. And if you Google it, you can find it. Probably 5 years ago, you know, someone wrote a whole long blog post / paper on kind of where he thought the internet was going. And I think it's proved to be very prescient. And it's basically just saying like, as bots get better, as AI gets better, like you're not going to be able to trust anything on sort of the open internet. And he likened it to like a dark forest where like, you know, you don't know what's out there. You don't really trust it. It's not like a safe place to be. And he theorized that people would retreat back into kind of trusted communities, you know, of people they know, group chats, identity authenticated forums, et cetera, where they actually knew real people and they wouldn't really poke their heads out into the dark forest of the internet unless they had to. And I think that's really come to fruition. I mean, I'm in so many more group chats than I ever was, you know, forums like ECF, like X and Facebook and Instagram, like they're all performative. Like it's all fake. Like, you know, I think people are craving authenticity and they're retreating in their bubbles, which I think is kind of sad.
I it's super sad. I mean, it's the whole golden era of the internet that we grew up in and still have maybe to some degree. I mean, isn't that what makes the internet great? Right? Like the pipes of being able to send messages and communicate with anyone, et cetera, and access services. But the really great thing about the internet is just, you know, the fact that you can connect with anyone anywhere, and it's an open place for ideas and sharing and inspiration. And it's sad if that's the truth, that bums me out.
It bums me out too, but I think it is the truth. I mean, think about, this is like a very cynical thing to say, but like the early internet was amazing because it was populated only by early adopters, right? By people who were relatively educated and curious and sharing freely and all that stuff. And like the broad masses were not on the internet. Like think about like parallelism, like think about Uber. Do you remember when it was like the early days of Uber?
I remember the first Uber I ever took. It was like one of the most magical experiences of my life. I was in Santa Barbara and I'd heard about this thing called Uber. Andy and I were taking a vacation and I hit the Uber button, and this normally does not happen. But in that instance, the Uber was parked literally 50 yards away from me, and I pressed the button, and in 15 seconds, he had drove up and was right there, and my head exploded. So yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah. And do you remember too, like you would get in the Uber and the driver would be so interesting, right? And you would have a conversation with him and he'd be like a good driver and like knew exactly where he was going because he was just another early adopter person, right? He was a cutting edge person who had figured out how to make money on the internet with this thing called Uber app, right? And so there was this massive selection bias, which you didn't realize at the time. And now you get in an Uber and what's it like? It's not a great experience.
It can swing wildly from.
My point is, it is no longer populated by kind of the cutting edge early adopter people. It is now populated by the masses. And I kind of think the same is true for the internet, right? And that early internet that you and I came of age in, I mean, I'm 39, you're 41?
42.
42. Like we came of age in this kind of beautiful, safe, open, friendly, early adopter internet, right? Like that is the true internet to us in our hearts that we remember. And I think, sadly, that was an anomalous period, not the true internet, right? Because so much of the world was not even on the internet at the time. Social media didn't exist. You know, it's so different now. I don't think we're going back there is my point.
No, I think you're right. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's going to be interesting to see how marketing evolves, because marketers, to be fair, we're both marketers, but I can also say marketers have a tendency to come in and exploit something until it kind of ruins it. And then, you know, people go somewhere else and then the marketers catch that. And then it's kind of a sad pattern that repeats. But you think about something like this and it's like, well, what's the next step for this? So you've got the wide open internet, and because there's so many bots and automated things that now can seem that are harder to tell if they're human or AI, that can do this ad nauseum, you know, infinitely, 24/7 at scale, everyone retreats into their own little communities. Where I try to think, like, what's the next step for marketers from there? Once you lose that trust, does it just go back to being, you know, more old fashioned word of mouth, building slowly, you know, kind of reputational, I heard it from a friend kind of thing, because you discount everything else you don't hear from a source that you deeply trust? And if that's the case, that's got implications that I think are great for long term building business for people that are in the game for a while and have patience and have, you know, kind of good character for it, but also makes it harder to build quickly. So I don't know. It's just interesting to think about how that's going to manifest in terms of implications for marketers.
Well, I think that sort of this idea, this influencer marketing thing will be over because nobody will trust it, right? Because soon enough, the influencers will all be AI generated and you won't be able to tell which ones are real and which ones are not. And I think we kind of swing back to a world of true celebrity, of like real, the only influencers you are going to trust are the ones that are so famous that you know who they are. You know, not like somebody that you just follow on the internet, like real fame, like actual celebrity, which is how the world worked forever and how celebrity endorsements work forever. And that, you know, that model really worked. We were just actually in this weird period where everyone was a celebrity for like 20 years, right? And like now that's not going to be trustworthy anymore. And you're going to be back to real celebrity, I think.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you think potentially, do you think it's just because you look at real celebrity and you think, okay, this person, they have a lot more to lose by putting their name behind it. So I can trust them more, or I've been following them for a while and I feel like I really know that kind of what they stand for and their character, and therefore I can trust them more. Is that
it's neither of those. It's like, why has celebrity marketing worked forever? It's pure halo effect. And this sounds crude, but they're hot. I trust them. Like that is what celebrity marketing, you know what halo effect is? It's like, if somebody's competent in one area, you deem them, your lizard brain deems them to be competent in all areas, the whole halo around it. And it work. And this is why hot people sell things, because your lizard brain, if they're hot, thinks they must be smart too. And they must know what they're talking about, which is obviously not true, but it hijacks the lizard brain. So halo effect is real. And these people are famous and attractive, and everybody else is looking at them, and everybody else seems to trust them because they're famous. And so our kind of social monkey brains go, well, I should trust them too.
Well, and I would say definitely attract, like there's scientific experiments that will show, you know, that have shown that people will trust and like attractive people more. It's just, it's not fair. It's just the way the world is. They've kind of looked at this with studies. That's part of it. But I also think if you look at people that are just deeply accomplished or highly proficient in their area, whether it's sports, whether it's business, whatever it is, et cetera, you get that same kind of halo effect. And that's not always, it's often not the case, right? Like maybe for hard work, yes. But people that are wildly competent in tennis does not mean they're going to make great financial advisors, you know?
That's true, except it doesn't stop them from shilling crypto and other things, right?
Oh no. Yeah. I'm not saying that it keeps them from trying, and people, you know, don't try to do it. I'm just saying,
but it works. People pay them to promote crypto because it works, because you are way more rational than the average bear. Most people don't even know what the halo effect is. And they just,
I'm so rational, Bill. I would never buy Asana based on a bunch of, you know, influencer marketing things. I'm about as rational as they come. So just for the
record. It worked on you anyway. Right?
It worked on me. Confessions, yeah, of a naive, should have known better man. All right, I want to move on to kind of what we've been reading. There's a great thread that popped up in the forums this week about what you've been reading. And I went through and kind of took a list of some of the top books. This cracked me up. Probably the number one most read book was people saying that they just reread Traction for like the fourth time or fifth time, which cracked me up. So the Traction books were in there a lot. And I'm going to get what you're reading now along with some of your favorites, Bill. But before we do that, have you read any of these and any thoughts on these? 10X is easier than 2X, Smart Brevity, or Who Not How were also some of the other top recommendations in there. You read any of those and have thoughts on any of them?
I have not read the first two. Is who is this the same guy, the top grading guy? The top grading guy's son, rather?
Not sure.
If so, there is a book called Who by the son of the guy who wrote Top Grading, which is the book about how to interview people effectively, which is a very effective interview strategy. Book Top Grading is really thick and annoying. And then his son wrote this book called Who, which is basically abbreviates his dad's book and is just better in every way. But the concepts are the same. So I don't know if that's the book that's being referred to.
So I think there might be two books, Who Not How, and then is Who a separate book? And then I think there is this. Yeah, there's a Who Not How and then a Who book, the A Method for Hiring. That's probably the top grading one you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Who Not How is talking about less so about hiring and more so about when you're trying to get something done, instead of trying to hire someone to build out a system for, worry less about that and worry about finding someone who's done it before and then get that person on your team and let them loose. I think, I could be wrong, but I think that's what that's talking about.
Now, there's actually been a number of good hiring threads in ECF recently. We had a new member that did a case study on his hiring system that I thought was really good. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, we will link up to that one as well in the show notes for this. I have not read 10X is easier than 2X, Bill. I have read Smart Brevity, and I thought that was a really excellent read and a good reminder on how important brevity is. I mean, even just now, you pretty much said, hey, there was this book about hiring and it was way top grading. It was way too long. People didn't have time for it. The sun came and condensed it. It was far better. And that's the book to read, right? Like, I feel brevity has always been important. I feel like in the day we live in today, you almost can't be too concise with things. And that was a good reminder from like everything from communications to marketing to interacting with your team. That's one I love and I would recommend strongly.
Yep. Everybody needs an editor, right?
Oh, yes.
Shorter, more direct, fewer words.
Mm-hmm. Almost always, good writing is succinct writing.
Hey, it's Andrew here. The quick sidebar to introduce you to Tal from popsmith.com. He's one of the owners over there where they create the absolute coolest, most delicious popcorn popper I've ever seen. I love it. Our kids love it. And Tal's an OG. He's been in the community for 10 years, instrumental in being getting it going off the ground and leading a number of meetups in California. And just a fantastic guy. And here's a snapshot of his experience with the community over the years with eCommerce Fuel, our community for 7 and 8-figure store owners.
I would say the one thing that is most valuable about the ECF community is the ECF live events. I never miss them. I only had one miss because there was a last minute change in the schedule. But the going to the live events, there's just so much value in not just the speakers, but more importantly, just connecting with other members in real time, in real life. Just no replacing human-to-human connection and the value of really just connecting with people in person. It's the best. It's something I'll never miss.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. What are a couple of your favorite? I've got two or three books here that are some of my favorite. I don't know if I wouldn't say this is an exhaustive list or the top three, but three of my favorite. But Bill, maybe we can start with you. Do you have a couple business books that are go-tos or ones you really love?
I have two favorites. One of them, and I mentioned it just because I recommended it again recently last week to a friend that was going through some hard times and he needed to do layoffs. And there's a book called The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz, who is one half of Andreessen Horowitz. And it's about startups. It's about being a founder. And there is so much great business wisdom in there, from like a chapter on how to do layoffs, like a chapter is about when to pivot, like all the hards. The basic crux of it is like there are some hard things that no one but the founder can do. And if you don't do them, no one's going to do them. And like, here are some of the hard things. And like, here's kind of like a field guide for like how to do them, like how to do a layoff. Like there are right ways and wrong ways, you know, to do a mass layoff. Like you have to fire, you know, half the company, you know, there's a way to do that. And there's some really good lessons in that book. And it's relatively short, but one of the best business books I've ever read. It's fantastic. The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz.
Nice. Yeah. I've read, listened to part of that. It's an intense book. He gets into it and yeah.
Super intense. Ben's an intense guy. He's a great writer also.
I tend to love business books, but I remember listening to that on a podcast and just being like, man, this is an intense book. I'm feeling myself tense driving down the interstate here. I think I had to change to something else for a little bit, but yeah, really good. And what's your other one?
My other one is the one that I've recommended for years, which is called Plain Talk by Ken Iverson. And I always recommend this one because no one has ever heard of it. This is like my favorite one no one has ever heard of. So you have not heard of Ken Iverson, but maybe you have heard of Nucor Steel. Maybe. They, at one point, maybe still are the third largest producer of steel in the world. But Ken Iverson took over in 1980 as the CEO. And it was called Nuclear Corp, a small business in South Carolina. And it was not all steel. And it was failing. And he built it from $20 million in sales to the third largest producer of steel in the world during a time when the steel industry lost 50% of its jobs. And it is about, it's fascinating because it was written like in the late 90s. And this guy was doing lean startup and like all of these ideas before they were called that, like way back in the day. His whole thing was like, there's four levels between the CEO and the guys on the line. He talks about like how they did variable comp. So like apparently making steel beams is a very like team activity. You know, like need a team of like eight guys and it's not individual. You got to all work together. And if you're good at it, you have much higher yield than if you're bad at it and not coordinated. And then the company makes more money. And one of Ken's innovations was he set up a comp plan where he paid these guys variable comp based on their output. And he paid it every week, I think it was. And like here, most businesses are paying like annual bonuses. And, you know, since there's been all this psychology research that show that like long-term bonuses are not motivating and you need to give people, you know, much shorter feedback loops. But he was giving these guys bonuses every week based on the output of their team's steel production. And he would post right there on the factory floor, like last week, every team's production. So everybody knew like who was winning and how much everybody was making. And I mean, if I ask you to think of an industry that is typically unionized, you would say steel making, right? Nucor never unionized and paid their people more than union labor. The unions tried to unionize Nucor Steel like many times. And they're the only steel company that like consistently rejected the unions because the workers didn't want them. They were making more than the unionized workers and they were happier. And there was always a line out the door to work at Nucor. So it's just his management philosophy is amazing. And it was written a long time ago. So there's a few anachronisms in the book, but like it's just very worth reading in a totally non-e-commerce industry. Like this guy was a real pioneer. It's pretty cool.
You recommended that book to me. I've purchased it and it has sat untouched on my bookshelf for years now. So I really I really need to dive into this one.
It's short. So, it's like 120 pages or something.
I know. It's I got no excuse here. So this is a good kick in the butt.
You'll like that one. And then my third one that I read recently, Same as Ever by Morgan Housel. So good. Everybody recommends his book, Psychology of Money. I know you're a big fan of that one as well, which I did like. But I liked Same as Ever, you know, the title gives away what it's about. It's about like, it always feels like, you know, with nothing like this has ever happened. It always feels like, you know, this time it's different, et cetera. And he just goes through and like systematically dismantles with a whole bunch of examples from the past of how everybody always thinks it's different this time. And like, these are the things that are durably the same. You know, it's like that Jeff Bezos quote, like, you know, it's easier to think about the things that are not going to change over the next 10 years than the things that are going to change over the next 10 years and build your business around the things that are not going to change. And so in some ways, you know, Morgan Housel takes more of an investing angle to it, but that whole mindset of what's not going to change, I found really fun to think about.
Yeah, I need to read that one too. Morgan Housel is such a good author. Does really good work. Great books. My three, I've got two probably people know and one that people probably are less likely with. The first one is Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink.
Jocko, yes. Talk about an intense book.
Yeah, it is. And it's the thing I like about this is, again, name pretty self-descriptive. I'm guessing a lot of people have heard about it. I think it's easy for me, I should say, when things are not going well, to point the finger. Like a lot of times, some people are really good at naturally just trying to figure out what they could do better. And I am not, you know, my innate kind of personality is not necessarily default to that. I'm like, what's wrong? Who's to blame? Like, and this book was such a good reminder for me of like, if you own the business and you're running the business, everything is on you. Somebody's not doing a good job. It's either because A, you weren't clear communicating with them. B, you haven't trained them well. C, and maybe you've done all the right things and they're still failing. And if that's the case, the problem is that you still have them there. As the leader, you have them in that seat. So it was just a really good reminder for me that like, hey, everything in your, there's maybe a few exceptions, you know, maybe acts of God, things like that, that you can't control. But for the most part, taking the ownership is not only the right thing to do, but helpful because then you actually have the control and can impact change. Anyway, I love that book.
Charlie Munger calls it the iron pill, which is basically, it's always my fault. And that puts you in, it sounds scary, but it puts you in control. If it's always your fault, it means you can do something about it.
Yeah. And it usually is your fault, right? If you're the leader. So
Well, yes.
Not even just nice framework, but it's just kind of the truth.
But so even if you're not the leader, there's another quote my friend Zach Kanner always sends to me. He goes, always ask yourself, how am I complicit in creating the conditions that I say I don't want? Like, what am I doing to make this happen to me, even though I'm saying I don't want it? Have I stayed in this job too long? Right? Have I stayed in this relationship too long? Do I need to move? You know, what am I doing? How am I acting that's making this bad thing happen to me? And if you really look in the mirror about that, you can turn over a lot of insights.
Yeah. And I think sometimes with business too, sometimes there are points, I think, in everyone's business career where you get to a point where you say, how did I get here? This is not what I want. And you kind of forget if you're the owner that you're in charge, right? That you can change things, that you can, you might be afraid, there might be consequences if you mess it up, but you have the power to change it, right? And I think that's the other nice thing too, is getting, internalizing, hey, if things are not the way I want them to be, I have the power to change them, which it sounds obvious, but I have many times forgotten that in my, in kind of my career. Yeah.
It's so, very human to forget that. And yeah. It's the key to avoiding the victim loop, right?
The second one is a book called 4,000 Weeks. And it's kind of, have you heard of this book, Bill?
Which one?
4,000 Weeks.
No.
It's the title of the book, I think, is based on the fact that, like, you roughly as a human, if you live to 80, you're going to have maybe 4,000 weeks on this earth, your lifespan. It kind of seems like it's a productivity book, but right out of the gates, most productivity books take the approach of how can you get more done? Right? Like, how do you fit more tasks into the day? Instead of getting 6 Zoom calls in per day, how can you squeeze, you know, 9 in, et cetera? And the book starts out and says, that's fundamentally the absolute wrong way to think about this, because there is no limit to how much you are going to have. The more productive you become, the more things will get on your plate, right? Like, you want something done, give it to a busy person, et cetera. And it says, you need to stop thinking like this way. The way you need to start thinking is, I'm going to drown inevitably. Things are always not going to get done. So if that's the case, I need to get really good at making sure that the things that I do are the things that matter in this life, right? And it kind of flips the whole idea of productivity from stop thinking about doing more and start thinking about doing the things that truly are important, both in your business and outside your business. So anyway, I loved the mentality with that book. And it was a refreshing switch from a lot of productivity books that are out there.
Basically, you're going to drown in, if you don't deliberately choose what to work on, all of the other things will invade your life and you will do the non-important things.
Yeah. Or if you get great at doing, if you're not doing the important things and you get better at doing the non-important things, you'll just do more non-important things, which is, I think, a lot of times what ends up happening when you focus on productivity, if you don't think really deeply about what you're doing. So. Yeah. And then the third one, this one's probably, you know, this is kind of a staple of the business world, but 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm not going to go into this too much, but I just love that book. It's, I think the pillars are really important. It's one of the first business books I read, stuck with me. And I think it's a classic worth reading if you haven't done it. So, all right, Bill, plain talk. I got to get to it. End of this year. If I don't have it done, I owe you another steak dinner. So,
all right, sweet.
Yeah. That seems like a fair deal. Last stop before we wrap this one up. Wealth advisors, a hard right turn here, but we were chatting about this before we hopped on, and not necessarily related to anything in the forums per se, but I know this is something you've been thinking about. We both come from the finance world, and I've always thought the wealth advisor thing was kind of it's an interesting world. Anyway, you've been chatting with a handful for various reasons, and you were kind of talking before we hit record that you just think it's an interesting industry, and you've been surprised at the different ways people do it. So thoughts on that quickly?
Yeah, I think everybody knows I sold my business, you know, 4 or 5 months ago. So when you do that, your inbox blows up with a whole bunch of wealth advisors that have seen the press release. And so I have just said, I'm going to learn. I don't know if I'm going to hire any of them, but I'm going to learn. So I took a bunch of these meetings, and it's fascinating in a couple things I have learned about wealth advisors. One, they can be very expensive. 1% of assets per year compounded is a lot. It's very expensive. But I also learned that most of the alpha, most of the benefit is actually not in picking stocks. Everybody thinks like a wealth advisor is like tells you what to invest in and tries to beat the market and all that stuff. Statistically, like 80% of stock pickers do not beat the market, right? Actively managed investing is sort of a fool's errand, right? Thus the rise of passive investing and indexing, you know, et cetera. But what has been really interesting to me is how much alpha wealth advisors can deliver by advising you on tax optimization and things like, if you want to own this dividend paying stock, you should own it in a retirement account because those dividends are taxed as ordinary income. Or like how to structure, especially for business owners. And this is what has really blown me away. Business owners are in this unique position in that we control the business entity and its balance sheet and cash flows. And also you have your personal balance sheet and cash flows, and you can kind of move money between them or make decisions about how money flows between the two sides of the ledger that can have either really good or really disastrous tax consequences. And the planning around that, I mean, things like QSBS in advance, your qualified small business stock in advance of selling your business, things like QSBS packing, where you put some stock of your business in a couple different trusts, or you gift it to other family members so they each get a $10 million capital gains exclusion. How to structure and set up a solo 401k. You know, do you want to have S Corp or not S Corp? And I know it's everybody thinks they should have an S Corp, but you don't always want an S Corp. There are some times when you really don't. And what I have discovered is that there are so many problems and challenges and opportunities that business owners have around kind of wealth management, tax optimization that doctors and lawyers and highly compensated FANG employees, et cetera, do not have. I sense that the business owner wealth management market is pretty underserved.
So is this something when you were chatting with them, that is this how they advertise? Do they, are they upfront about saying like, hey, you're going to hire us, you're going to pay us this, what a looking, you know, seemingly egregious 1% of assets under management. We can't pick great stocks for you, but we can help you on the tax side. Is that their pitch or
no, are they not still- always. That's okay. What's so interesting. Some of them are like, we can definitely beat the market and we are really good investors and you should invest with us. And, you know, we're Goldman Sachs and we have access to all these private equity funds and we're going to put you in this and this and this. And when you hear that, generally, you should run the other way, right? Because all of those things are layers of fees on fees on fees, illiquidity, so you can't leave them. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be very aware of that. So there's a huge amount of that still in the industry, a huge amount of it. Like, you know, there's also a huge amount of like, we will invite you to cool parties with the other JP Morgan clients. And, you know, we'll introduce you to all these other cool founders who are also our clients. And there's certainly like a, we're going to make you feel cool because you are using insert name of Wall Street firm to manage your wealth. And that's a selling point as well as some of them do. So, and then others will talk more about tax, asset location, optimization. Some of them will have very much an index first strategy, but I've just been struck at how different they all are. Like if you've kind of met one, you've met one. And, you know, similarly, like as you stack up some wealth, you then start to have estate planning concerns, trust planning concerns. Like there's other stuff. And we've talked about this, you and I, a little bit on some past episodes of this, you know, like how you tax efficiently transition wealth to your kids or not, right? How you tax efficiently give money away if that's something that you want to do. And those, our tax code is so complicated in this country, I think on purpose, you know, that having somebody to navigate it can be very valuable, especially in the first couple of years.
So what I hear you saying, Bill, is we need to change ECF membership from a fixed fee to a percent of revenue.
Exactly.
It's a smarter model, right? That's.
I mean, it's certainly a better model, right? it's a better business model if you can get it.
Totally depends on who you're asking there. Yeah, that's fascinating. And you made the point too when we were talking earlier. I've always thought that the wealth advising industry is just I was talking to some people I'm close to and they were asking, hey, like, you know, we've got all of these existing stocks and funds at this brokerage firm and they called us and they want to, you know, they said that they'd manage it for us for like a percent per year. Should we do it? And I almost like screamed at them. I was like, no, don't, what are you doing? Like, you know, when I told them how much it was, and they could have done the math, right? But when I told them, I was like, hey, here's what they're going to tell you. Here's how much they're going to charge you per year in dollars when I just did the math for them. They kind of flipped out, you know, because it's, and that doesn't even take into account the compounding effect of it. So you had mentioned something like this, like the fee per advice in the step model, advice for fee as opposed to advice for percent under management is such a better model and such more aligned interests, it feels like to me, than what a lot of people do traditionally.
So, I mean, it's certainly better for the client.
Yes.
Right? It is definitely not better for the advisor.
Right.
But, yeah. You know, and it is what I came into it thinking like, you know, AUM fee is like a total ripoff and there are no scenarios under which it could work. But I have since kind of come to it's complicated position on this. I think that the first year or two with an advisor, the advisor gets a bad deal. It's a lot of work to understand somebody's situation, to restructure all their stuff. Like, I think the advisor loses money on the first year or two of the relationship. And then, so you get kind of this like J curve situation where the advisor basically invests their labor and then you stick around, you know, and they make money with you on the long tail. What I also sort of fail to anticipate is, you know, for someone like me, like I'm pretty savvy. Like I really like investing. I'm interested in tax optimization, et cetera. And what I fail to kind of appreciate is there's a whole fraction of the world that just has zero interest in this, like at all. Like our good friend, Blair Budlong, like he is, I was talking to him about this and he's like, I am not, like I have a guy, I don't want to know. Like, I don't want to think about it. Like, I want to be able to call him anytime and have him handle all my stuff. Like, I don't care that it's expensive. Like, I'm buying a service and it is worth every penny to me. And I was like, how, like, you know, but it's different strokes for different folks, right? And, you know, especially business owners, like we can get so complicated. And if you are not into this, and I kind of didn't appreciate the degree to which I am into it, you know, so the value equation for me seems maybe a little upside down, but for a lot of other people, it seems totally worth it.
You are more into it than almost anyone I've ever met. I tend to be someone who like goes through my tax return and in detail, even though it's, you know, extensive and like, but even as someone who feels like I have a decent rap on this stuff, every year I have to be like, well, wait, why are we doing this? And what's this again? And I have to kind of remind myself it is to make sure you're not leaving money on the table, of which the tax structure and thinking through that is probably one of the best ways you can do it. There's a lot there. There's a lot of moving pieces, a lot of things to consider. Yeah. And just the longer the tax code gets, the more nuanced and complicated it is.
And they change it all the time, right? So you've got to, and that's kind of what I mean about an ongoing relationship, because like the tax code changes. And so you think you're all totally positioned the right way, and then it changes and you've got to kind of restructure and pivot.
But why not, you know, the way I do it is I manage my own investments. I pay a CPA who understands the tax code exceptionally well to help me think through those things. There's maybe a few, I mean, your point is that there's like some bleed over and some things.
Yeah, there's overlap. There's for sure yes. overlap between a good CPA and a good wealth advisor, but there is a substantial portion of tax optimization, ironically and weirdly, that is not the purview of CPAs.
Yeah, like what would be, you've got a business, you've got your portfolio of investments, real estate, et cetera. I feel like I talk with my CPA about all of those things. And maybe I'm not talking to him about the fund selection, et cetera, but I feel pretty good about doing that kind of stuff and how I want to put that together. But for example, if I had, you know, if I was buying a bunch of, you know, stocks that paid dividends and I wasn't maxing out tax advantage accounts, I think he'd be like, what are you doing, dude? That's dumb. So where's the extension of, do I just have a great CPA or do you think is there a lot more to it I'm missing?
You probably do have a good CPA, because many CPAs will not say, hey, you're not maxing out your tax advantage accounts, or like, hey, did you create a solo 401k for this consulting entity? And did you know you can have a 401k through there and a 401k through work and blah, 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 blah. Right? There's a lot of CPAs that don't go that far. But then there is also a whole bunch sort of outside of that. Like, as I sort of mentioned earlier, like, are you holding dividend paying stocks in your retirement account? You know, are you, you know, where you're not going to get a tax drag? You know, are you having, you know, long-term kind of high upside investments in a tax deferred account, you know, rather than paying taxable income on all that? How are you thinking about your estate planning, you know, your trusts? Like, what if you're gone, you know, and then the estate attorney gets involved and someone's got to play quarterback, you know, with all of those different things. One of the wealth advisors I talked to also introduced me to a concept called long short direct indexing, which is fascinating to me. So you're making a face that makes it look like you want me to explain this.
100%.
Okay. So so everybody's familiar with index investing, like you buy the S&P 500 ETF or whatever, right? Are you also familiar with the concept of tax loss harvesting?
Yes.
So like a stock goes down, you can sell it, recognize the capital loss. And so long as you don't buy it again for 30 days, which would create what's called a wash sale when you don't get the loss. As long as you stay out of that security for 30 days, you can take a tax loss and offset against some income.
And then you could rebuy it later if you need to, or something similar.
You can rebuy it 30 days later. You can buy the exact same thing 30 days later. But what you can do immediately is buy something similar. It has to be like substantially different, but like you could sell Coke and buy Pepsi, you know, metaphorically. So there's this concept when you have a little bit more capital called direct indexing. And direct indexing is, instead of just buying the ETF, like one security, because baked into your ETF is 500 different securities that are moving up and down, right? If you do direct indexing, you buy all, use an algorithm, use to buy all 500 stocks. And so you have a brokerage account with 500 positions and a market cap weighted to replicate the ETF. But now you can do tax loss harvesting on each of the individual, because like the index might be up 0.1% today. Some stocks are up 5%, some stocks are down 5%, right? And everything in between. And so you can be tax loss harvesting all along the way. And because you have to be out of those ones that you lost harvest for 30 days, it does create some what's called tracking error, where your performance versus the index can drift. You know, sometimes better, sometimes worse, but there's some drift with direct indexing, but you can start throwing off captured losses, harvested losses by direct indexing.
And they do this, they have a division within whatever bank it is that does this all for you, I'm guessing.
Tons of. I mean, yeah. Wealthfront even will do direct indexing for you now. You don't need a wealth advisor to do this. But what you do need a wealth advisor for, although this is getting democratized also, is the next step, which is called long-short direct indexing. So direct indexing is cool for the reason I just described, because it throws off some losses and generates pretty minimal tracking error versus the index. So pretty much a free lunch, or darn close to a free lunch. Long-short indexing is, imagine you put some leverage into the portfolio. So the ones that go down more, but they are offset by the ones that go up because they went up more. So you're basically magnifying this. You magnify the tracking error. The tracking error can get as high as like 1.5% in either direction versus the index, but it can throw off in like 4 years the entire invested capital in losses, like a huge amount of losses. So if you have long-term capital that you want to track the index with, to use this strategy called long-short direct indexing, you can throw off substantial capital losses over the life of your indexing investment, which you can be used to offset capital gains elsewhere.
Wow. Just offsetting capital gains or earned income as well?
You might be able to use it for earned income.
So you're telling me that if I had, let's say hypothetically, if somebody had a portfolio, let's say $500,000 portfolio, they invested in this long-short kind of strategy you're talking about, it could over the course of 4 or 5 years create $500,000 in losses that could offset your other income while at the same time growing your capital at roughly plus or minus 1%, the same as the index.
Correct. That is what I'm telling you.
I was about ready to launch into a whole rant about how sometimes just keeping things simple is the way to go because it keeps your plan easier, but that's pretty compelling.
It's pretty compelling. It's super interesting. Now what's the catch, right?
Yes.
So there's sort of two potential catches. Catch one is the fees are higher because there's the short, there's interest on the short positions
and,
you know, it's algorithmic, right? But they can charge more for it because there's, you know, there's value being created there. But even after fees and cost of leverage, the after tax, it creates like between 1-2% a year of after tax alpha versus holding the ETF, which is very significant, compounded over a lifetime.
It seems like I would expect it to be more than that. Are they just jacking the fees way up because they can?
If you generate $500,000 of losses, that only saves you $100,000 of taxes. Because right, so that is an incremental over, you know, many years, $100,000 on your $500,000 investment. But and here's the other rub: you are building up more and more embedded gain in the portfolio. So to unwind it, you have to realize a bunch of gain, right? And in fact, more gain because you have recapture on the losses. So the losses are eroding your basis in the portfolio. So to unwind it negates a large, not all, but a large portion of the alpha. So your options basically become die and pass it to your heir. Well, die and pass it on as a stepped up basis, right?
Option number one, you're done.
Die.
You got an extra 2 points, but you got to capiche.
Because your heirs get stepped up basis, right? So all of that, all of those embedded gains are eliminated. Of course, there are some downsides to that. to say the least.
A few.
Your other option is to give it away, is to do some charitable planning and then donate appreciated stock and take the write-off. You can and then the third option, which is really interesting, is called an ETF 351 exchange, where you can donate the appreciated 500 different positions into a new ETF that is forming. People are just kind of starting to figure this out. There's a rule in the tax code where if you donate stock to an ETF that is being seeded, you get to transfer your basis into there. So you can donate a concentrated position or a complicated position and end up back in an ETF. All of your gains are still embedded, but you can get out of this sort of complicated long short strategy and roll back into an ETF.
Interesting. That's fascinating. It's kind of a little bit like if you have a rental property, people always talk about, oh, depreciation. Appreciation's great. It's wonderful. It's great. And it is till you go and you sell the house, and then you realize, oh, wait, we sold the house. You know, you have all of these recaptured depreciation that you weren't expecting that creates this massive tax bill for you. That's fascinating. Bill, you got to write some kind of like crash course ebook. I don't know, wrap this into the consulting you do for, I don't know, you probably can't do that legally, but it's safe to say you geek out about this stuff. I feel like I enjoy finance and I like geeking out this stuff. You take it to another level. It's fun to hear how you think about this and the cool stuff.
Back to why this is helpful for business owners, right? If you're going to sell your business, you're going to have a large capital gain. So if you are already, if you own a business that you hope to sell one day and you are already investing in the stock market, right? Instead of holding the ETF, start a long short strategy now, build up a whole bunch of losses, right? Which will roll forward on your tax return until you sell your business. And then all those losses will offset the capital gain from selling your business. Something I would have loved to have learned 5 years ago.
Say it one more time, long short in direct indexing.
Long short direct indexing. And there's a company called FREC, F-R-E-C, which I have no relationship with, but they are kind of like Wealthfront, but they are bringing long short direct indexing and regular direct indexing kind of to the self-service market. So you don't need an advisor.
So you should call them if you want to do that, or if you want to help them with their PR and branding campaign strategy there.
So I really should like be dropping an affiliate link right now, but I'm not.
Yeah. Fascinating. Super cool, Bill. Thank you. Bill, we got to wrap up here. Always love doing this with you. Like I mentioned at the top, he is the co-host of Acquisitions Anonymous. Make sure you're listening to that. If you're not, it's a phenomenal podcast. They do short, punchy, really insightful episodes on businesses that come up for sale. So it's a great way to see all the different types of businesses out there, how smart minds think about them critically. He, of course, is a long tenured e-commerce store owner and still working with, is it still called Natural Dog Company? It is, right?
Natural Dog Company, yeah. And we've been acquired by Food Science, which is our parent company now.
Food Science, as well as consulting. Are you still doing consulting? If people are interested in learning more about the one-on-one consulting you do with store owners, how can they learn about that?
Yeah, BillDA.com. You can get in touch with me. You can learn about it. You can find my newsletter. You can find the podcast, everything, BillDA.com. I'm very Googleable, so you can find me.
Looking forward to blowing up downtown Bozeman here in a couple weeks with you, my friend.
Can't wait. Highlight of my year. See you soon.
If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.